Great. All right. You guys see that blue light? Okay. I'd like to call the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water to order, and I'd like to go over the agenda, and you may want to get out your compass to follow. Bearing in mind that I have a former speaker in the room, I'm going to do my very best, but he's going to wonder, is this how you run a railroad? And I'd like to announce that we are going to carry over House Bill 3145 to our meeting on Tuesday, the 19th of April. And I'm announcing that we are going to carry over House Bills 3595 and 3516 to the same day, which is, again, Tuesday, April 19th. The first bill that we're going to hear today is House Bill 3129, and I'm going to open a public hearing on that bill. And I'd like to ask our colleague, Representative Kettemer, if he'd come up and share his testimony with us.
Did you say 3129?
If I said 3129, it was an error, and I meant to say 3121.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Co-Chair, and members of the committee. Bill Kettemer, State Representative for the City Canby area. Thank you for the opportunity to come and speak with you on House Bill 3121, and I also want to thank you for rescheduling that opportunity, as had a little health crisis in the meantime. I do want to say a couple of things in advance of talking about this bill, because what it requests is the removal of the $5 fee that was put on kayaks previously. And I have a set of amendments, which I think your assistant has that's provided to you, and we'll talk about those in a moment. But let me say a few things about this. I am very supportive of stopping invasive species, as I think any Oregonian would be. And just on a personal level, I watched the demise of Diamond Lake. It was one of my favorite recreational sites. It was a great place for many weekends with my family, and we had a lot of fun fishing there. But while supportive of stopping invasive species, I have a couple of problems with this bill. One of them is in the nature of the fee, and I would tend to be inclined to call it sort of a stealth fee. It's been a difficult one for people to understand and know about. I think there's been a huge PR problem, and a lot of people simply don't know that they need to do it. I also think that the $5 is a modest amount, an inconvenient amount to pay, but a modest amount in terms of its good, and I question whether it's really the best way in public policy to try and deal with things like this. I do have some concerns, and I know that there is effort to improve them, but a week and a half ago when I bought my permit, this is what I'm supposed to keep on my kayak. And my kayaks are used a lot by my grandchildren. And you can imagine trying to keep a piece of paper like this. It will withstand the water now. That's helpful. But trying to keep it in or on a kayak is a challenge. And I appreciate that there are some efforts to improve it. And I think these are some things that can be improved and resolved. I would also note that some of the concerns about kayaks are, in my mind, a little misplaced, because most of us transport them in part by hand, usually by car, but then by hand down to the river and back, or the lake. And as a general rule, since water weighs about 8 pounds per gallon, we drain them. And a lot of us are fastidious enough, we also clean them. So invasive species tends not to be a problem for most of us kayakers. But the piece that really has me riled about this is the outrageous fine for a $5 error. And I think we always want to make sure fines fit the crime. In trying to find this, I found four different variations, but the ballpark, and we'll use the one that was given in the testimony last time, is there's a $99 fine for a $5 violation. That seems pretty far above what's reasonable. But if that weren't bad enough, the insult is there's also a $55 administrative fee. So that's $144 for a fine for a $5 violation. And not a very good way to have fun, which is, I think, principally what kayaking is about. And let's put this in perspective. To drive without your seatbelt, which I think is substantially a more serious violation, is $97, $2 cheaper, plus your administrative fee. So, yeah, thank you, and I appreciate that. I just think it doesn't pass the straight face test or a good test. I also think that it's $94 for failure to have a motorized boat license on your boat, and we all know they need to be registered. I think it's unfair to violators, who many of whom don't even know about it, and it also puts law enforcement in an extremely awkward spot. Are you really going to give people a $144 fine for a $5 mistake, or $5 plus $2 administrative fee, $7 mistake? I hope not, but we ask people to enforce the law. So in that spirit, got together with Director Scott Bruin of the Oregon Marine Board, and I want to thank him, and he is here, for working with me. We put together some amendments that we think might make this a much more tolerable situation. It's sort of modeled after the snow park permits, and we eliminate the huge fines and the administrative charges and go with a $30 fine if you have no permit, and hopefully even then, since ignorance is not an excuse for the law, but it is common. Maybe law enforcement will work with people on this, because the real thing is to get people to do the right thing. And then, secondly, a $50 fine for out-of-state motorboats who didn't get the required $20 permit. I think these Dash 1s meet most of my concerns now. They at least address the problem of reasonableness or get close to it. I would be remiss if I didn't take just one more moment to have a little bit of whining and some thoughts about the future. I have here my sports pack and my kayak permit, only one of the five that I need. And the tally was $171.75 just for me. My license and that. I just think that, we need to start thinking about the impact some of these fees are having upon our families and upon their ability to have recreation. I know when I was younger and my family was young, we had a hard time making ends meet. And with that kind of expense, that concerns me. But I would encourage your support of the Dash 1 amendments. I appreciate your rescheduling this and allowing me to come forward. I would ask you to have a work session to move the bill forward. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments?
Coach, your hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kettenberg. I just want to confirm that the effect of these amendments would be to continue the requirement for the $5 permit, but
yes,
to reduce the fees to $30 for non-motorized boats that don't carry a permit and $50 for motorized boats that don't carry the invasive
species. It's for out-of-state vessels. We have a $20 in. Scott, I think I'm getting this right.
In-state is automatic.
In-state is automatic. So all of us that have boats, it was included in our re-registration. But for out-of-staters, there is a requirement that they pay a $20 permit to fish in our waters. And this allows that fine to be $50 because they were tied together.
Interesting. Follow up, please.
Yeah, but it does continue the $5 assessment, and there's going to be a continue. And incidentally, the Marine Board is working diligently on trying to figure out how to solve that permit so it somehow you can tie it to your kayak or glue it or do something.
Good. Other comments or questions for our colleague, Vice Chair?
Representative, originally boats under 10 feet were exempt.
Yes.
And they're not now.
Boats, non-motorized boats were exempt.
Yeah.
And, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative. Originally, non-motorized boats in Oregon did not need to be licensed or did not need to pay a fee. And under the provisions of the bill last time, we created a $5 invasive species permit for boats above non-motorized, above 10 feet. Yeah.
So boats under 10 feet were exempt.
They're still exempt. So, for example, I have a whitewater kayak, and it's 6 feet 6 inches. It's exempt. and was exempt under the new statute. And all of them were exempt prior to that statute.
When you say the new, you mean the new bill, not the new statute?
Well, the new statute that came into effect when the legislature implemented this fee.
Okay.
That's what
that, that is
Chair.
Current.
Yeah, the current law.
Thank you.
Is that good, Vice Chair? You're good on that point, or do you want another comment?
Well, I was trying to figure out from looking at the amendment where there's the exemption still in there or not. Because it doesn't talk
about... Because it doesn't change current law. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. But
please,
I think...
Speak up.
I may need... Do you want Mr. Bruin to come forward and help us?
Yes.
Thank you.
Please, Mr. Bruin. Identify yourself and welcome.
Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, Scott Bruin, Director of the Oregon State Marine Board. So what was the question?
The question is from my vice chair.
The amendment that appears takes up the first section, and what I was referring to in the original bill, RS 835.65, one, a person may not operate a, and then the manual propelled boat is 10 feet or more. That's been taken out. Motor on waters of the state without first obtaining aquatics. Okay, so that exempted them out. Now, has that changed where they're back in?
Chair Gilliam, Representative Krieger, there should be no changes in this bill to how the law was originally written as far as who this bill applies to. It simply changed the fine for those that fail to carry the permit for non-motorized and out-of-state motorized boats.
That's my understanding as well. I hope it does that.
If you have a further question, you punch right in, but I'm going to go to Representative Thompson.
I tend to agree with you about the overall policy, though, as to whether this is about invasive species or it's about raising revenue. I mean, I assume then that you're telling me that there's no way that you're capable of spreading invasive species with your 6-foot kayak, but your kayak over 10 feet is definitely an invasive species threat. I have the same problem with my 9-foot canoe, which I assume the invasive species cannot cling to, but I have a 14-foot canoe that probably is an invasive species problem. Is that where we're going with this? Maybe it's about revenue instead of about application?
Who is, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, are you talking to me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
I was going back to what you were saying about what are we really trying to do here. If this is a taxation policy, let's call it that, but I'm having a little problem with a foot of length means it is or is not a problem for invasive species when we know your hip waders are potentially a problem.
Yeah. Well, and actually, that's true, Mr. Chair and Representative Thompson. Hip waders are also a concern for some of these. I was hoping not to get into this part of the discussion because I think your point is one that's not been lost on a lot of us. And there are other inequities. For example, the 5 kayaks that I own are all at a property on the Umpqua River. They don't leave that property.
Yeah.
They are not a threat to bring endangered species in, frankly. And I think a good majority experience similar kinds of... But, when you start exempting one group, it gets difficult. And I thought at least, the under 10 was a standard, and it was the standard that was chosen last time. I didn't see any reason to change that.
Any other questions or comments for either one of these guests? If not, we're going to request the proper paperwork on the dash ones, and we will have to return to this since we can't move the bill today.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Bruin, for coming up. And, Representative, I'm not surprised at your flexibility and the astute way in which you've been working with the Marine Board, and I appreciate it. And I'm very happy that you are here, because we all know why you weren't here. But I have to go on record and say, on behalf of the Warner Pacific College Alumni Association, I am appalled at your apparel today.
And most of I guess I should point out that these wonderful colors are not only the Beavers colors, they're the Kennemer campaign colors.
All right.
And
you're,
so there is, that's all right. There is some additional justification.
That helps me.
Thank you very much for this hearing, and I wish to express again my appreciation to Mr. Bruin and folks at the Marine Board for helping this work. I think this is a good compromise and meets everybody in the middle in a reasonable way. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I look forward to the work session.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3121, and I'm announcing that we will carry over the work session on House Bill 3121 till our next meeting. I'm going to open up a public hearing now on House Bill 3109. And I'd like to call our colleague, Representative Garrett, to come forward and share with us his testimony.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, fellow colleagues. Thank you for hearing House Bill 3109. This bill is the product of extensive work during the interim following the adoption of Senate Bill 513 last session. This bill is really about moving the state in the direction of market-based solutions to ecosystem preservation. It's something that environmental advocates and industry representatives and citizens and small business owners should all find common ground in. Our approach to environmental preservation too often has been one of top-down regulation, and this bill recognizes that many times there are alternative ways to achieve our conservation goals using market-based solutions rather than a regulatory approach. Senate Bill 513 was adopted, I think...
Identify.
I'm Chris Garrett. State Representative, House District 38.
Thank you.
Like us, we go.
I recognize you.
Mr. Chair, you and I were co-sponsors of Senate Bill 513 last session, and I'll never forget the look on your face. I think you sponsored that bill and promptly forgot about it. And then when it came up for a floor vote and you saw that you were the sponsor of an ecosystems bill, you came to me with a look of raw panic and sheer terror on your face as it approached a floor vote. But you held firm. And that bill sailed through the House and the Senate, and it resulted in a work group that led to the bill before you. You should have the -2 amendments, and there are also a -3 amendments, which are very much the same with one difference, and I leave it to your judgment about which of those amendments you feel you should proceed with. I'm going to end my testimony here and leave it to those who are more knowledgeable than me about the mechanics of this bill and what it would do to talk more about it. But I thank you again for the hearing.
I'm sure my astonishment was more about you recognizing me on the floor than it was the bill itself. But do we have any questions for Representative Garrett? Seeing none, thank you for getting started.
Thank you.
Is our next guest here? No. Secretary of State. Would you recognize him? We're going to proceed, but a bit of a surprise, maybe shouldn't have been. We have a number of testifiers, and so I'm going to have to limit everybody who is testifying on House Bill 3109 to 2 minutes, and we'll be strict. But you are welcome to submit written testimony. I want to urge you to give us the distinctive points of your testimony. Please don't read your testimony, and we're eager to hear from you. And to have any supplemental written that you have. So, with that, I'm going to ask Sarah Vickerman, Tom Byler, and Louise Soliday to come on up. And my able co-chair will be my timer today. Self-select.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Tom Byler. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 3109. OWEB supports the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments of House Bill 3109. We have not had the opportunity to see the Dash 3 amendments, so we can't comment on those. We at OWEB have a very distinct interest in the ideas and policies are surrounding ecosystem services, markets, and payments. In essence, OWEB, as a grant program that invests dollars into habitat restoration and protection for native fish and wildlife and water quality purposes, we are an investor in ecosystem services. Since we're very interested in how these policies develop, we staffed the task force on Senate Bill 513 over the interim that led to many of the recommendations embodied in House Bill 3109. So we're very supportive of those ideas. Four key points I want to make briefly. 3109 is important because it creates the potential through the encouragement in this bill to allow the public sector and private sector to develop alternative paths to address natural resources management issues outside of the current regulatory and permitting structures. We still have to meet the standards of those programs, but this creates an opportunity for us to look at innovative, creative solutions as an alternative to the typical system that folks have to deal with. It also, secondly, provides a basis for us to have a much deeper understanding on how to quantify and measure ecological benefits. That has direct benefit to OWEB's programs. We're very interested from that standpoint. Thirdly, it creates an opportunity for landowners to have new economic opportunities relating to their land, essentially to be paid to protect and restore ecological values on their lands. The example that I like to use is for landowners who have a stream running through their property that has listed salmon. Landowner might consider that to be a liability and restrict the use of their property. Under an ecosystem services approach, that property, that liability could be turned into an asset.
Tom, a quick summary statement.
Summary statement. Thank you very much. As part of my summary, I want to declare that we have a fiscal impact relative to Section 3 of this bill that can be addressed through the governor's proposed budget, so we want to put that on your radar screen, and that this has broad support among state agencies, some of which you'll hear from today.
Thank you.
Please. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Vickerman. I'm the director of the Northwest Office for Defenders of Wildlife. I was involved as one of the partners in the Senate Bill 513 that you passed in 2009, and was involved in the work group over the interim, which met many, many times for a very long time, right? So a few high points from the written testimony. Ecosystem services are important because they provide benefits to people, clean water, clean air, flood control, damage control, that sort of thing. Ecosystem markets, then, happen when there is a demand for these ecosystem services that landowners can provide to potential buyers. Potential buyers could be voluntary buyers, they could be regulated buyers, or they could be agencies who want to protect ecosystem services as part of their mission as the Department of State Lands and Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board and other agencies do. A very important point is that this bill absolutely does not propose any new regulations. That decision was made by the work group early in the process, and we have not violated that at any point or any version of the bill. It also does not eliminate any current regulations. It simply provides a more creative way to deal with them in a manner that hopefully is more ecologically effective and with lower transaction costs. What the bill does, and you have it before you, and we're supporting the Dash 2 amendments, is that it highlights the importance of addressing ecosystem services when making decisions. It provides a process for multiple conservation plans to be integrated. It offers a more effective approach to mitigation. It addresses the need for more consistent measurement of ecosystem services, and it encourages agencies to think about using natural infrastructure in place of hard engineering where that would be more cost-effective and have a broader suite of benefits. So who benefits from this legislation? Well, businesses and governments with mitigation responsibilities will have a broader range of options for compliance and more confidence that their investments will really produce tangible results. And in the package of letters that we distributed to you, you'll see lots of letters from business interests that say that's why they like the bill. Landowners will have the opportunity to sell ecosystem services to voluntary or regulated buyers or to government investors. Local governments also like the bill. The Association of Oregon Counties, for example, and the City of Portland support it because they're looking for new tools to support the restoration of critical infrastructure. Agencies get stronger partners. Conservationists like it. You have a dozen or so conservation organizations supporting it. And Oregon's economy then will benefit from the investments that are made in these restoration activities, largely in rural communities. So in my testimony, I've gone through what the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments do. I won't bore you with that unless you have questions, except to say that the Dash 1 amendments essentially defanged the bill. Virtually everywhere that it started by saying shall, it says now something like may or is encouraged to or or might consider considering or something that's rather soft, because we think it's appropriate in developing these new tools that we not be too prescriptive at the outset and let agencies experiment and be innovative.
All right, we're going to hold questions for the whole panel, and thank you for your testimony.
Okay.
Please.
Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. We are here to support House Bill 3109 with the Dash 2 amendments. We were participated on the Senate 513 Task Force. We've been involved in the ecosystem services marketplace for many years. Our mitigation banking program is a perfect example where private landowners go out, develop mitigation, wetland mitigation banks on their own lands, and then sell those credits to people who need them for mitigation under the removal permit program and the Corps of Engineers 404 permitting program. We're also a landowning agency, and we're very interested in the potential revenue that we may be able to get from selling ecosystem services credits off the lands that we manage as an additional source of revenue for the Common School Fund. And so we are very supportive of this legislation. As I indicate, we're already participating in the ecosystem service marketplace here in Oregon, and with that, I will stop.
Thank you for your brief testimony. Panel, stay nearby in case there's questions, but I'm going to ask our Secretary of State to come forward, and we would like to have her testimony. We're pleased that she gave us a few minutes. Honored that you would come.
Thank you.
And I want you not to be nervous. I don't know if you're familiar with this whole way.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, my apologies for being late. I was attacked by a bunch of beavers on my way to the hearing room.
It's so, going around.
And I'm concerned that you let the certified smart people leave the dais because they can only answer all the questions that you will have. So
they're backing you up.
For the record, Kate Brown, and I serve as Oregon Secretary of State, but the reason why I'm here today is that I chair the Oregon Sustainability Board, and House Bill 3109 is a bill that the Sustainability Board has supported and is working for its passage. Just to give you a little background on the Sustainability Board, it was created in 2001 with almost unanimous support from the Oregon legislature. The purpose was to set sustainability goals for state government. Members of the board include folks like John Ledger at AOI, Judge Mark Webb, Grant County Commission, and Professor Robin Collin at Willamette Law School. In 2009, we advocated for the passage of Senate Bill 513, which was the prior bill, and we worked with the Watershed Enhancement Board to establish ecosystems markets and this particular legislation. Frankly, I see ecosystems markets to create an alternative path through the regulatory process by streamlining permitting and reducing the cost of compliance for projects that invest in Oregon's natural ecosystems. Let me give you an example. In 2004, Washington County performed a pilot project with Clean Water Services and the DEQ. To meet water quality goals, they needed cooling towers, which were slated to cost between $60 and $150 million. It was done for $6 million, less than one-tenth the price. Instead of building the costly infrastructure, Washington County used natural shading, planting trees streamside to reduce energy use and achieve habitat restoration, and also reaching water quality goals and saving Oregon taxpayers serious dollars. We are the nation's role model in creating markets for ecosystem services, and I think you've already heard some testimony today about how House Bill 3109 fosters flexibility for Oregonians by encouraging cooperation between the governor's office, local governments, and the Institute for Natural Resources, which has been a vital resource for all of us. I see this legislation as a win-win-win. Hopefully, the greater flexibility will put more Oregonians, particularly those living in rural communities, back to work on sustainable projects. In the case of the Washington County cooling towers, which I mentioned, we put those dollars into the landowners' pockets as a supplement to their income for good stewardship of their land, and certainly an investment in our local economies. And then for local governments, it will save them precious taxpayer dollars and reduce administrative costs. We hope that House Bill 3109 will increase the pace of rehabilitation and conservation for our most ecologically sensitive areas. House Bill 3109 is the next generation of Senate Bill 513. I'm not sure it's quite like the Star Trek version, but I really encourage you to continue Oregon's legacy and leadership on ecosystem service markets. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair and Committee.
Thank you for those comments. Do you have any comments or questions of the Secretary of State? Seeing none, thank you, Madam Secretary, for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for your attention.
Yeah. Colleagues, do you have any quick or specific questions for the previous panel of three? If there aren't any, I'm going to call the next panel. And I'd like to have John Charles, Lisa Gaines, and Jim Myron come forward. And you heard the drill. It's 2 minutes. We welcome your testimony, written, and 2 minutes oral. John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit research center. I've been interested in market-based environmentalism for over 40 years. And it would be great if this bill would advance the cause and would work, but I'll call to your attention what I consider to be two potential problems. One is, which I don't see addressed either in the bill or in the dash 3 that I just picked up, all these phrases, ecosystem services, ecosystem integrity, ecological values, ecosystem assessment, spatially aligned and coordinated, those phrases, by and large, don't actually have any meaning out on the ground. An ecosystem is not a discrete thing. There are ecosystems, inside of other ecosystems. So when people say ecosystem services, people sort of generally know what they're talking about, but at the grassroots level, out in the field, these things don't really have specific meanings, and I think that's a problem when you get into accountability. And my second point, drawing from that, is in both Section 5 and in Section 7, you talk about purchase credits and credits for compliance. Well, that's making the problem worse. I mean, in a voluntary market, you can have sort of fake commodities. Carbon offsets are a good example of a commodity that doesn't actually exist. In a voluntary world, that's fine. But when you start talking about compliance, there's nothing in the bill, at least, that defines what a credit is. And maybe it's referenced, maybe Louis Holliday mentioned a DSL statute about credits, and maybe that's what it means. But to the reader of this bill, at least to me, I don't understand what a credit is. And if you start involving people writing checks with a lot of zeros and they expect something in return, I think you need to have a real contractual understanding of what a credit is, how it's enforced, how it's carried out. Because in other contexts, such as carbon offsets, if you actually follow the money, there's a big enforcement problem because they don't actually exist. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Right on time. I appreciate the comments. Please.
Mr. Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair and the committee, my name is Lisa Gaines, and I'm the Interim Director for Oregon University Systems Institute for Natural Resources. The Institute's mission is to facilitate the use of and access to relevant science-based information methods and tools to better understand natural resource management challenges and potential solutions. Over the last couple of years, we've been working in the area of ecosystem services transactions. I've been working with Oregon University faculty members, non-governmental organizations, the private sector, state and federal agencies to look at and share information about ecosystem service transactions. Most recently, we've been funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the U.S. Geological Service, Geological Survey and others to be able to focus on this. Currently, we're developing a nationwide web portal to be able to share information with practitioners and researchers. Most of our work in the Institute for Natural Resources and in this area is funded through grants and contracts. And I'm here to speak on the role of the Institute for Natural Resources, which is in Section 4.1. And it says that the Institute for Natural Resources is, to the extent practicable, provide information to local governments, state agencies, federal agencies, conservation organizations, private landowners, and businesses to assist in the development of public domain integrated ecosystem services methodologies. And it lists a number of things that that's supposed to do. What I am here to testify is that we interpret this to be permissive rather than directive. And if this bill is permissive, that there will be no direct fiscal impact on the state funds in terms of the proposed role of the Institute for Natural Resources, as we will seek external funding through grants and contracts. If we are not able to gain those grants or contracts, we will not be able to do the work.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Myron, representing Waterwatch. My written testimony goes into a few areas in the bill that we think need a little bit more wordsmithing, and we just simply ask for the opportunity to work with the sponsors on the Senate side to address those concerns. We've spoken with the sponsors. They're willing to do that, so we look forward to that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. A model of brevity. See if there are any questions for these three folks. There are not. You're excused. Thanks for being here. We'll move to Peter Doherty, Danielle, maybe Hagerty, and Margie Bradway.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, I am Peter Doherty, Acting Private Forest Division Chief with the Department of Forestry. The Department of Forestry appreciates this opportunity to provide testimony in support of House Bill 3109. The department has long supported the development of ecosystem service markets as a means of increasing the economic viability of Oregon's working forest. The Board of Forestry's draft 2011 Forestry Program for Oregon specifically identifies ecosystem market development as an important policy objective to help maintain Oregon's working forest. We also think that properly designed and implemented, these markets could also address some unresolved issues about regulatory inequities faced by forest landowners. The department has reviewed and supports inclusion of the amendments, and we particularly support the affirmation of Oregon's longstanding policy to provide incentives to private landowners to conserve ecosystem services. And we also support providing for an integrated methodology that are flexible enough to allow private landowners to receive payments for multiple types of ecosystem services. Thank you, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Please.
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, I'm Daniel Hagerty. I am before you as a citizen. I also happen to co-chair the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, but my comments are as a citizen. Secretary of State Brown hit on almost every point that I wanted to hit on. I will just leave it that I strongly support this bill. I think it is very well crafted, and I really appreciate the work of the SB 513 work group and everything they put into it. I think the only concern I've heard so far is regarding terms like ecosystem services and purchase credits. I can assure you that the capital markets in New York are not concerned about these terms. I was just there this last week in discussions. There is a ripeness for private capital to come into Oregon, and this will help spur that. And I think this will have strong economic benefits throughout the state, including the rural communities. So I just strongly support this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Margie Bradway. I'm the Sustainability Manager for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. As you know, ODOT owns and manages a large amount of public land, and ODOT also spends a lot of time and investment in mitigating for environmental impacts. This bill would allow ODOT to not only mitigate for those impacts, but also avoid and protect the unique and sensitive ecosystems in a way that will increase project efficiency, reduce timelines, and also benefit the environment. Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions for this panel? Mr. Haggerty, is that right? Haggerty?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to put you on the spot, but I'm just interested in the context of the bill as you understand it, and I appreciate your comments. How would you define credit in this context?
We know now that if we do a certain amount of restoration along a certain stream, we will, in fact, reduce the temperature of that stream, and we can predict it, and we can monitor it to prove it. And that reduction in kilocalories, or however you want to measure that, is a credit. And that can be traded. To the Secretary of State's point with Clean Water Services, that is, in fact, what they did. Rather than putting it into concrete and cooling towers, they put it into restoration of riparian areas, and they achieve kilocalorie benefits. There's a credit.
Okay. Thank you for that answer. Any other questions?
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And to follow up on the Co-Chair's question, maybe you could share with us the methodology that the OWEB is considering having to create to keep track of all of this, because in following the tax credit situation with the Betsy and others, I find that the mechanisms that our state enjoys are vastly underdesigned to manage the volume of credits, and the technical expertise that's required is significant. So my question is, do you believe that the board is currently equipped to manage this type of a proposed device? And if not, what's it going to take to do it? And keep in mind, I'm measuring what you're answering against what I call a borderline debacle on the Betsy situation.
I appreciate your question, Representative Benz. The way I look at it, there's a few different ways to make it work, but a lot of that administrative requirement for the accountability and reporting will be part of the cost of the crediting, is I think the direction we're going to go. For OWEB, we will do it only to the extent that we do our monitoring already, but we'll frame it a little bit differently so that we're much clearer on the accountability and the tracking than we otherwise are able to.
Thank you. And for the record, Mr. Chair, I do know how to pronounce tobacco, just so you know.
Right. Well, it's duly noted. Thank you. Others? Thank you all for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Finally, I'd like to call up Dave Honeycutt and Sean Cleave. Last time we invited Mr. Cleaver,
he texted me. He was in the hearing room. He was watching on the TV.
Okay, he's in.
Oh, here it is. Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, Members Committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. Speaking in support of this bill with the Dash 3 amendments, we are opposed to the bill in its original form. We are opposed to the Dash 2 amendments, but we would be supportive and hope the committee will adopt the Dash 3 amendments. What the Dash 3 amendments do to the bill, They're very similar to the Dash 2 amendments. The only difference is the Dash 3 amendments remove Section 2 of the Dash 2 amendments, which applies to the Land Conservation and Development Commission. What the Section 2 of the Dash 2 amendments do is change and add additional language to a provision in Chapter 197 that directs, that prescribes the overarching purposes of the land use program and adds language requiring the protection of ecosystem services as part of the overarching purposes of the land use program. We are very concerned that language, which the Land Conservation and Development Commission, which LCDC would be required to, or would at least look at it. The language is not mandatory, but what LCDC would be required to look at would lead to the adoption of a new statewide land use goal relating to ecosystem services. We have 19 statewide land use goals. We don't want a goal 20 that would then have to interplay with goals 3, 4, 5, and the other goals that those of us in the land use business deal with all the time. So we're very concerned with Section 2 of the Dash 2s. If the Dash 3s were adopted, we'd certainly be pleased and would be happy to fade into the background.
Thank you. Sean?
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. I don't want to be repetitive. I will just say that the Farm Bureau supports the Dash 3 amendments for all the reasons Mr. Honeycutt just laid out before you. And with that, I'll close my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. Any questions for these two gentlemen? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Thanks for coming forward. I'm going to close the public hearing on this House bill, and I'm going to tell you the number, 3109, and I'm going to hold over the work session on 3109 to our next meeting, which will be Thursday. And now I would like to open a, hold on just a moment. I'd like to open up another public hearing, this time on House Bill 3325, and ask our colleague, Representative Frederick, if he'd like to come forward.
Good afternoon,
Representative Frederick.
Co-Chairs Gilliam and Cannon and the rest of the committee. Thank you for letting me speak before you. I'm Lou Frederick, representative from District 43, North and Northeast Portland, and I come before you to describe the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3325. I've been before you already on this subject, and we've done a lot of homework and collaboration since then, and what we bring now is a more narrowly focused than the two bills that we proposed earlier this session. As before, this is about brownfields, those relatively small contaminated sites that we all have in our neighborhoods. To recap, all parts of the state have them, rural, suburban, urban, defunct gas stations, dry cleaners, chemical storage sites, and other places too small to qualify for Superfund or other major attention, but too contaminated to be used for residence, agriculture, recreation, or commerce. It's a reservoir of available space, often in excellent locations, if cleaned up. What this bill will accomplish is to create a path to certainty on the part of prospective purchasers regarding their liability for the mitigation of sites contaminated by prior activities. Uncertainty is at least as big a barrier as cost in these cases, and this sort of assurance can open doors to both lending and investment. That's good for the environment and good for business. I believe you have a letter of support from the Associated Oregon Industries. I hope you have that. I want to thank the co-chairs and their staff for their patience and their assistance in this process. I also want to thank the representatives of the DEQ, the Port of Portland, and the City of Portland, who are with me today, for their collaboration. We're asking to hold this over because we just received final edits from Legislative Council about an hour ago on the Dash 1 amendment to HB 3325. We're prepared to answer your question for your questions if you have some now, or we're prepared to stay prepared for later if that works for you better for your agenda.
Thank you, Representative. Co-chair Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify for the committee and confer with Representative Frederick that we're looking at Dash 1 amendments that would be a complete replacement of the underlying bill. This is a gut stuff and actually doesn't bear any relation to the underlying bill except it happens to work with the relating clause.
Absolutely the case. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for being flexible and prepared. I appreciated your comments the first time you ran on the subject and now on this specific bill. Are there any other questions or comments for our colleague? If not, thank you for coming forward, and we will call up the folks you referenced.
Great, thank you.
And we will be holding this over, as you also referenced.
Thank you very much.
I'd like Palmer Mason, Dan Eisenbeiss, and Douglas McCourt to come forward if they would.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm going to make my remarks to the Dash 1 amendment. And I want to say that the Dash 1 amendment and the whole idea here was a relatively simple one, and that is if you were someone who didn't cause contamination and you were going to buy a property and do some public good with that, that the state should try to encourage you as much as it possibly could. That was the genesis of this legislation. And as Representative Frederick alluded to, it's been a bit of a long road to get to this point, so we definitely appreciate the committee's patience. But this is a good idea because if you can turn contaminated property into productive use, if you can put a business there, we can see jobs, our local governments can see additional tax revenue, and in doing that, we can also clean up the environment. So it seemed like a real win-win for both the economy and the environment. The Dash 1 amendment does that, helps reach that goal in a couple different ways. One way is it expands the liability protection for these type of entities, and we call them innocent purchasers. Again, these are people who didn't cause the prior contamination on the property and are coming in under an agreement with the Department of Environmental Quality to clean up the property. And under that agreement, this legislation would expand their protection from lawsuits, including protecting them from lawsuits by a third party. So a third party might be somebody like a neighbor who is impacted by a plume of contamination that goes from the property that the innocent purchaser is going to acquire over to the neighbor's property. And while on the surface that may sound like a problem, I would like to suggest it really isn't, because that neighbor or that third party has every right to go and sue the original party who caused the contamination. And the only entity that we're trying to protect under the Dash 1 amendment is someone who had no association with the contamination, that innocent purchaser. So that's one of the things that the Dash 1 amendment does. Another thing that it does is it provides that expanded liability protection through an administrative order, so DEQ can do it through an administrative order, rather than having to go all the way through the court system. The bill provides the option of either going through the court system to get what is called a consent judgment that would provide this expanded liability protection, or the same thing can be available through an administrative order. So the department, working with the innocent purchasers, can decide on what's the best course. And obviously going through an administrative order in some cases will be beneficial because it's fewer attorney fees, less time, fewer court costs, that type of thing. And then the other thing I wanted to add is that the Dash 1 amendment provides expanded liability protection, not just for the release of hazardous substances, which is what Chapter 465 is all about, but it also extends that liability protection for innocent purchasers, again, under the state's two spill programs, both for spills for oil and spills for hazardous materials. And that, again, ought to help innocent purchasers look at properties, contaminated properties, and turn them into productive use. So that's a very quick summary, Co-Chair Gilliam and Co-Chair Cannon, of the amendment. I did want to add very quickly that I appreciate the leadership of Representative Frederick on this issue, on brownfields as a whole, and on this bill specifically. I appreciate the committee's patience with us and working through this issue. And finally, I would like to say that it has been a good partnership to work with the Port of Portland and the City of Portland on this issue. We've all had the same goal. We've had some legal issues to work through, but everybody's been committed to delivering this bill to the committee, and I just want to recognize that. So thank you.
Thank you, Palmer. Is there anybody on the committee specifically you're more appreciative of than another?
I plead the fifth on that one.
All right, so. That's very wise. Okay, Dan Eisenbeiss. Mm-hmm.
Chair Gilliam, Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeiss with the City of Portland. I've spoken to you before on this topic, so I'll keep my remarks brief. The city is in strong support of providing the maximum amount of legal certainty to parties who are not responsible for contamination on sites who agree to take on voluntary cleanup of those sites. We believe that it both helps the environment as well as the economy. This is a very good effort and one that we hope that you'll support. We'd like to express our appreciation to DEQ, the Port of Portland, and the committee, as well as Representative Frederick, for all of the work on this effort so far. I'd be happy to take any questions.
For that reinforcement, Dan. And Douglas, you're up.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee. My name is Douglas McCord. I'm a partner in the law firm Vader Wynn in Portland. I am not here today representing any particular client, but rather as an individual who has spent much of his professional career since 1988 helping folks clean up, redevelop, buy and sell these brownfield properties. I urge the committee's support of HB 3325 as amended because it is designed to provide greater certainty and protection to the businesses, local governments, nonprofits, individuals, and others who seek to purchase contaminated land and provide the public benefits required by the existing portions of the statute through cleaning up and returning these lands to productive uses. HB 3325 as amended is pro-business and pro-environment. It'll benefit all Oregonians without cost to the state or the stakeholders involved in brownfield cleanup and redevelopment. It's important that the record of this legislative debate, in my view, record that while the bill applies prospectively to agreements and the orders enforcing those agreements after the effective date of the legislation, that the legislative history acknowledged the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality has assured those parties whose agreements and orders predate House Bill 3325, the state of Oregon will continue to work with and assist those parties in the amendment and the reentry of those agreements and orders to provide the same benefits as provided by House Bill 3325 as appropriate. And lastly, in addition to acknowledging Representative Fredericks from my part of town, I want to acknowledge the professional dedication of Mr. Charlie Landman of the Department of Environmental Quality, who has dedicated the last two decades of his career to the prospective purchaser program and who's responsible for bringing many damaged and distressed properties back to life for the benefit of all Oregonians. Thank you.
Well said, and thank you for taking the time to come. Any questions or comments for this panel? Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to compliment all of you for the hard work on this piece of legislation. Incredibly important, and I'm sure very, very positive for the state. I just had one question. There's the federal laws that I don't see anywhere here. What impact, if any, does this have on those?
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, I guess I can answer that, and certainly Doug can add any comments he wishes to. This being that it's a state bill, we're limited to impacting state law, and these are the incentives that we can provide under state law. I understand, and again, Doug may be able to comment on this more deeply than I can, that there are similar provisions, I think, under CERCLA. And so this would be another layer that would be removed, but again, only at the state level. So,
very briefly, Representative Benz, when the original version of ORS 465-327 was passed, adopted by the Oregon Assembly in 1995. It did not contain these provisions because the last two decades of interpretation of the federal statute upon which most of Oregon statute is based was read differently by the U.S. Supreme Court. Over the last decade, there have been a series of cases that have turned that jurisprudence on its head and unfortunately allowed direct actions against from one potentially responsible party to the other. In fact, I attempted to negotiate these very protections in a prospective purchaser agreement over the last 2 years, and basically with the department realized that this wasn't just my problem, it was everybody's problem in the state of Oregon, and there needed to be a legislative fix, not just a one-off fix in each order that was negotiated. So, but to really put it shortly, you know, Oregon based its law on the federal law in many respects, in this respect very closely, and because of these decisions in the U.S. Supreme Court over the last decade, we need to fix a problem that has previously not come to light.
Thank you, Representative. Co-Chair Cannon.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. We have a letter in support of the bill from AOI, and there's a they note the how effective the agency's prospective purchaser agreement program is. I think you've alluded to that, and I want to read just one line or a couple lines. The DEQ's PPA is one of the most successful programs in the country to deal with these sites. It has catalyzed the recovery and development of hundreds, if not thousands, of cleanups at virtually no cost to the local taxpayer general fund. I think we hear it out in the public discourse and sometimes in this committee concern about DEQ and its efforts to regulate the environmental laws that this legislature has put on the books. I appreciate the fact that we have an opportunity here to recognize the ways in which I think DEQ sometimes bends over backwards. Sometimes my constituents would say bends over too far backwards to meet industry, landowners, regulated parties halfway with alternative compliance scenarios, with liability protections, et cetera. And I appreciate the testimony to that regard.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Any other comments or questions at this point? Thank you, gentlemen, for coming forward. I had saved the last word for Annette Price, but after hearing everyone testify, apparently that last word is ditto. Is that right?
That's right.
All right. So I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3325, and I'm going to announce that we will hold over a possible work session on House Bill 3325 until our next meeting, which is this coming Thursday. Moving along, I'd like to open for discussion. Okay. Colleagues, while we may not take final action today on this bill, I am going to open a work session for the purposes of having discussion with two important testifiers. So I am opening a work session on House Bill 3597, and I'm asking if Palmer would come back up from the department, and also Mark Simmons would join us. And we would be pleased to hear your comments.
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, co-chairs, members of the committee, Mark Simmons, we are grateful for your interest in this bill, House Bill 3597. We have been working with the department on some appropriate regulation for a new technology that has outstripped the regulatory framework that is in place today, and believe that we have a good piece of compromise language that will allow us to move forward. We have amendments being drafted, but they are not available today, and appreciate Palmer working with us toward that end. We believe it will be something that will be functional.
Thank you.
Yeah. Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality, and I appreciate Mark's comments. I appreciate his opportunity and the bill sponsor's opportunity, Co-Chair Gilliam, to work on some compromise language. Mark is correct. DEQ's regulatory framework doesn't really fit well with these conversion technologies, but we recognize that we shouldn't be a barrier to these kind of opportunities, and they were willing to work with us on some language that I think gets them where they want to be. allows us to protect the underlying policies in the solid waste statute that we wanted to protect, and we are going to work with them on the permitting issues so that we can get the right permitting tools in place for what are some very good businesses that are keeping some materials that shouldn't go to the landfills, out of the landfills, and making some useful things with that. So we recognize that, and again, I appreciate that Mark and the bill sponsor, Co-Chair Gilliam, were willing to give us that opportunity, so thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for these two?
Yeah.
Co-Chair Cannon.
Do you have time to do this work between now and our deadline for moving House bills, which, as you know, comes up next week?
Oh, Co-Chair Cannon, are you speaking to the amendment?
Yes.
I think yes. The amendment is, and I should probably be a little clearer, the amendment will remove sections 1, 2, and 3 of the bill. So the only part of the bill that will be left in the amendment would be the business tax credits, which isn't DEQ's issue. And then we would have substitute language that should be able to be processed fairly quickly and straightforwardly that we could do. And I will have that language to the committee today. I understand that Representative Gilliam's office has provided a note, and I will be sending that language to the Legislative Council.
Good. Thank you.
Follow up. That language will deal with the permitting issue that appears to be at least a big component of the challenge that the company has faced.
It will, Representative Cannon, Co-Chair Cannon. What it will provide is that waste plastic that's converted for oil for purposes of energy recovery will count for recycling under our law. What it does do, which is what the department's interest was, is it doesn't change the definition of recycling, and it doesn't affect the hierarchy. It's a cross-reference to that point, but I think it achieves what the Agriplast and Agilex and Waste Management were interested in. The permitting issue will have to be dealt with as we do new rulemaking, but we are committed to undertaking that rulemaking expeditiously. We are going to provide a letter to Agriplast that says we will maintain the status quo with regard to their permit until we have developed new permitting rules that really fit these type of companies and the work that they do.
Great. So just to go over it real quickly, and for the committee members, in the short term, we can get the amendment that we need for this bill, for this session. And in the long term, the permitting process and the rewriting, one of my goals, and I think you share this, is that we have that in place before, and by that I suppose I mean January of 2012, before we go into the second part of our session, of our annual sessions. Is that accurate?
That's certainly workable for us, Mr. Co-Chair.
Co-Chair Gilliam, at this point, all I could do is commit that we would try to do that. Unfortunately, we do have to follow the Administrative Procedure Act, and there are requirements for us to follow in rulemaking. It is our intent to get it as moved along as far as we can by that date. But I guess I feel like the committee would have the opportunity, if we aren't moving sufficiently quickly enough, to file a bill and do something different. So that I hope that for the sake of the industry and for the sake of the committee, that serves as an adequate check and balance. And we are bound by the Administrative Procedure Act and have to move through that. So I cannot guarantee or promise that we would be done by that date. I wouldn't want to do that.
Well, and I appreciate the answer, and I believe that's true, and we'll continue in the communication. But I want to be clear, that's my goal. Okay. And I think we can achieve that based on the way we're working together now on this bill and based on your answer. Is there any other comment on this? No? I want to thank you both for coming forward. Before I close this, I neglected Mike Dewey. I don't know how it happened, but Mike, come on up, and we'd like to have your comments as well.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs, members, Mike Dewey, Waste Management. As you may recall, and you hear a lot of testimony, that Waste Management is actively pursuing a permit with DEQ to operate a facility you've talked about and we've talked about in Northeast Portland. What I do not want to have happen here today is any indication that this would delay the permits that we're working on. I don't think that does that, but somebody might say, well, let's wait and see what happens to the legislation, number one, and then it passes and we'll get into rulemaking and we'll delay your permit. We do not want that to happen, so we're willing to go through this process within under the confines of the rules that exist today, and we think we'll get there. There is some use to the other parts of the bill also, so we do support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Any other comment necessary on that? Questions? Great. Thank all three of you. Now, before I close this, I want to make it clear that we are holding over this work session, is that correctly stated, for our next meeting, which would be Thursday. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And with that announcement that we are holding this over, I will for now close the work session on 3597. And lastly, colleagues, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2622. And I would like Ivan Malusky and John Audley and Jeff Bissonnette to please come forward. We'll have one more after that. Brendan's here. And because we only have three chairs, you're going to get the last word. Committee, would it be helpful to have a summary of this from Liz? Yeah. Would you?
Of course.
And on the amendment that we're talking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee.
Sorry, I sprung that on you there.
House Bill 2622 would allow, under certain circumstances, energy conservation projects to qualify for the Oregon Renewable Portfolio Standard. The Dash 1 amendments, which are before the committee, would specify, they are gut and stuff amendments that would specify that electricity generated from a renewable energy source by a facility ceasing to burn coal as a fuel source after January 1st, 2005 may be used to comply with the Renewable Portfolio Standard.
Thank you for bringing us back into the game. And gentlemen, we're ready for your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
We've had a change there.
Yes, I'm sorry to do that for you while you weren't looking. Jeff asked that I take his place since this is sort of our bill and we're probably the
well, Jeff's very difficult, and I appreciate the change.
Well, thank you for letting me testify today in Jeff's place. Brendan McCarthy, for the record, representing Portland General Electric. PGE is an investor-owned utility serving 822,000 customers in the Northern Willamette Valley. We also are the 65% majority shareholder owner of the Boardman coal-fired facility in Boardman, Oregon. We're here to support House Bill 2622 as amended by the Dash 3s. Some of you may know that we've just completed a process at the end of last year that took most of last year and resulted in a DEQ rule that sets Boardman toward closure, or at least the ceasing of the coal burning at Boardman by the end of 2020. And that's one of the reasons why we're here talking to you about these Dash 3 amendments. We're currently in the early stages of our R&D efforts on how to replace that resource. That resource is about 15% of our total energy that we receive from our facilities and a significant portion of our resource portfolio. As part of the discussions in ceasing the burning of coal at Boardman, we agreed with a number of stakeholders and parties that we would discuss replacement options that are low or no carbon emitting, including non-fossil fueled resources. So we're beginning to look at how to replace Boardman, and one of the possibilities is, and we're on the cutting edge of this on the R&D, is looking at torrefying biomass, which will look a lot like coal, and burning it in the facility at some later date. Crucial to the economics on this is that if we do that, it will qualify as a renewable. Looking at the renewable standard, it became clear that at least there was a question as to whether using an older facility like Boardman would qualify under the renewable standard, even if it used a renewable fuel. So we believe that the Dash 3s clarify what was the original intent of the RPS. Those were three major things: fuel diversity, economic development, and environmental benefits. Converting Boardman from coal facility So one that's fired by homegrown, closed-loop, dedicated energy crop can do all three of these things. It provides fuel diversity. It allows us to develop a baseload renewable resource of 300 average megawatts. It retains the jobs at Boardman and in the Boardman community, which are about 110 full-time jobs at Boardman. It creates investment in potential torrefaction facilities. And it ends the use of coal while converting and reusing in a sustainable manner an existing infrastructure that's already there. So we don't think it makes sense. It's ironic that if this coal facility was built in 1996, we wouldn't be here today. But it wasn't. It was built in 1980. So we're reusing that facility, and we think that's a very sustainable thing. With that, I'll conclude my remarks and say thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is John Audley. I'm the deputy director of the Renewable Northwest Project. For about 17 years, we've been advocates for responsible-sited renewable energy projects in Montana, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. Our members are comprised of both for-profit companies dedicated to promoting and building and operating renewable energy facilities and nonprofit organizations committed to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Today I rise in support of 2622-3 with the inclusion of a critical word missing from the draft prepared by legal counsel. While I was not a party to the original creation of 838 over the past couple of days, I've actually enjoyed reading some of its history. Go figure. 838 was designed to expand the state's portfolio of renewable energy by promoting a wider variety of renewable technologies. Among those technologies recognized by 838 was biomass. And 838 stipulates various kinds of fuels, including dedicated fuel stocks eligible under the state's RPS. The statute is silent on what to do with a facility built to use coal, but capable of being converted to use 838 consistent fuels. We believe it is appropriate to encourage power generators to adapt and use cleaner fuels. Many states stipulate conversion criteria. In our view, the amendments proposed in the -3 provide sufficient assurances to keep this bill narrowly focused on the state's sole coal-fired facility. To be clear, RNP is not taking a position on whether or not the fuel and technology envisioned by Portland General Electric is appropriate. Whether or not both torrefaction and the cane stock meet the state's other criteria, including possible invasive species and wildlife implications and consumer cost and risk concerns, is a matter for future discussion. As you folks probably know, and I know my friend Brendan does, we believe there is an abundant supply of renewable energy out there, and we look forward to engaging PGE in the formal process designed to help the utility figure out where its future fuel needs are met. The slight change that I'm referring to is in HB 2622-3, Section 1, Paragraph 2BA states, should the bill, states, any electricity generated from a renewable energy source by a facility may be used to comply with a renewable portfolio standard subject to ORS 469A-135 if the facility burned coal as a primary fuel source, not just fuel source. Thank you.
Chairs Gilliam and Cannon, for the record, my name is Ivan Molesky with the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club. We're here to raise some concerns about this bill and state our opposition at this time. A little bit of background, the Sierra Club was the lead group in initiating a lawsuit, a Clean Air Act lawsuit, over the Boardman coal plant back in 2008, concerned with what we believe were violations of the Clean Air Act dating back many years, and which the Environmental Protection Agency flagged to go back to at least 1998. We have very engaged in the public process around the ultimate decision to close Boardman, and we hope to be part of the process in future integrated resource plans around the replacement power for Boardman. And I want to actually acknowledge that Brendan from PGE here came a couple of weeks ago with these amendment concepts, brought them to our attention so that we could be informed and be able to provide our input, knowing that I would be likely to raise these types of issues. So I appreciate that. And we certainly believe that there's good faith here. Now, though this bill really deals with a technical element of the renewable portfolio standard, I think it has larger implications that are worth considering. While in some ways PG is in a bit of a catch-22 in that they would like to bring on biomass as a new source, but they're dealing with pre-1995 boilers. But on the flip side, they're proposing a technology that simply does not exist yet as replacement power, and that there are, in fact, many real options in place right now that they could begin investing in much sooner than 2020 that we can and we believe should be encouraged in the transition. So so just a little bit of extra context here. You know, the average I don't know what the average biomass plant size here in Oregon is, but I will say that you don't often see them at larger than 30 megawatts. You see a lot of 10 to 15 megawatt plants. You see smaller plants in all sorts. And in many ways, you know, PGE could begin now building a series of smaller plants around the state in search of the replacement power for Boardman by 2020. We have never seen in this country, let alone Oregon, a biomass facility on this scale, potentially, Brenda mentioned 300 average megawatts. The plant could produce up to 585 megawatts. So there's a tremendous size differential between what this is and what existing biomass looks like. Now, the reality is we are burning something out there. We would much prefer that we encourage a transition to a renewable source or a mix of sources that don't involve burning material, because inevitably there are air emissions, there are carbon emissions, there are other factors. And one of the keys here is we really don't know what the environmental implications of this switch over to torrefied biomass would look like. We don't know what the water and irrigation types of issues for growing potentially 100,000 acres of cane out in Umatilla County are. We don't know what the air emissions are. You know, we brought litigation under the regional haze rule to protect the Columbia River Gorge, national parks, and wilderness areas. We do not know what the implications are yet. And there's legislation in another committee that we're concerned about how it would relate to this, that would make essentially a scientific finding declaring biomass to be carbon neutral and then exempt it from greenhouse gas emissions reporting. So if that legislation were to pass and this were to pass, ultimately we have concerns about what are we not seeing from those smokestacks coming out of Boardman. So, and in the future, right now, you know, they're talking about a cane grass, which they've received, I believe, very conditional approval to grow a small amount of and then do some test burns in the next couple of years. We don't know, though, whether that's going to that will pan out, and they will have to transition to another fuel source, potentially we don't know if it's going to be hybrid poplar, genetically modified products, wood waste that currently the timber industry is competing for in our federal lands, and all these types of issues. So I bring these issues mainly up to talk about this because I believe that if we move forward now, we will not decide the fate of this plan in this transition, I think we're making some decisions that have some big implications. And because this is not a proven technology yet, we believe that there's time for PGE to do the proving, the technological work to make sure that this is even viable, and we can come back in 2 years if we need to and have this conversation again. I don't think there's any sense of urgency around making this change to the renewable portfolio standard now, and I'm worried that what it does is send PG down a road of searching for a new technology that doesn't exist instead of looking at technologies that do exist to make that transition by 2020. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
Mr. Chair. Just a question. If PGE was to start down the path today of building a brand new biomass facility like the one that's envisioned for potentially for Boardman down the road, would that facility qualify for our renewable portfolio standard as a qualifying electricity source?
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, the answer to that question is yes. If we went down the path of building a new facility starting today, it would qualify under the RPS.
Okay. My comment is I believe this to be really a technical fix. I mean, basically to say that the mere fact that a facility has previously been a coal plant should not disqualify it from our inclusion under the RPS, and if I'm wrong about that, I hope somebody will correct me in you know offline. But that's my impression and understanding of this bill.
Happy to comment if you wish.
Sure.
Co-chairs, I believe that's correct. If you look at how when the RPS was created and the line that was drawn on January 1, 1995, it was drawn to exclude older renewable sources, and that's the crucial piece here. You can look at the information that came out of the Renewable Energy Working Group, and you can see the debates that happened over drawing that line. And drawing it at 1995 ensured that the state would see 2,100 average megawatts of new renewables, and that was the goal. It excluded the old hydro, it excluded old biomass facilities that were existing renewable biomass facilities at the time. And that was why that line was drawn. It was to encourage new renewable generation. And as you stated, this would be new renewable generation. It's a coal plant now. It's not renewable.
Thank you. Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee, I just want to point out that yesterday in Olympia, your colleagues passed legislation that will close Washington's only coal-fired power plant in 2025. So between our two states, before we're all in the grave, our two states will be free of coal-fired generation within the state. And I think that's a moment to celebrate. So thank you.
Thank you all for your testimony. Jeff, for sure. Oh, you are coming. Good.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. A quick correction on something Brendan McCarthy said. He did not speak in my place. He just spoke first, which I almost never allow him to do. But since it is PG's bill, I figured it made sense that he got a chance to explain it. I just want to come before the committee expressing Cubs support of the amendment. And I think Representative Cannon really hit it on the head that we are, what we are saying is if we have a coal plant in the state that ceases being a coal plant and there's a level of investment that is made that makes it able to be run on a renewable portfolio standard approved fuel, then it should count for the RPS. I have to say on a personal basis, this was actually pretty thoroughly discussed as part of an RPS rulemaking advisory group at the Department of Energy. And myself, I saw no reason why this couldn't be adopted in a rule. And to this day, I'm not exactly sure why the department wouldn't do that. I actually don't think this is a clarification that's needed in statute, but somebody does, apparently, and so here we are. But we worked very diligently with PGE. PGE has been acting in very good faith to make this clarification. We did it over a 6 or 7 month period last year. This wasn't adopted in rule, even though it was recommended by the committee, and so here we are. There was something else I was going to say, but it's probably not important. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Are there any questions? You seem like you're going to...
Well, I noticed that we do have a representative of the department here, and since Mr. Bissonette has raised it, oh, she's shooting me a look. But I think that looks like she wants to come up and put a few words on the record about the department's position on this issue.
Thank you, Jeff.
If that's okay.
That's great.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lisa Panero, Oregon Department of Energy. Actually, I'm not prepared to state make any statements about the bill. I did note the question about the rulemaking. We do have advice from the Department of Justice that we did not have authority to enter into rulemaking on that issue, and that is why we did not.
Great. Okay. I think that's sufficient.
It's a good clarification. Thank you for coming forward.
Thank you.
If there are no other comments or questions on this bill, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2622, with the additional comment that we will hold over a possible work session for our next meeting, which is Thursday of this week. So with that, the public hearing is closed. And unless the committee has anything else for the good of the committee, I would like to say that while I am sorry that, and I'm sure you're experiencing this in your other committees, that we don't have all the paperwork and we can't do the action, we did get a lot accomplished here. And I just want to say on record again how much I appreciate my co-chair, because there's a lot of good stuff here that we're finding ways to move ahead. And I'm looking forward to the action that we're going to take the next week. And you'll have the gavel on Thursday. We thank you all for coming. And I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water.